views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because
they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest is Bob Zimmerman. I'll get more to that in just a minute, but a couple of very quick announcements. For those of you who would like to call and talk with Bob, and remember the telephones are our preferred way of communicating on a show, it is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners, so be patient, and we'll answer and get you up on air as quickly as possible. Remember, we hold callers over the break. Sometimes we skip the break, and we answer the phone during the break if we're taking a break and you call. So don't let a break stop you from using the phone. Again, it is our preferred way of communicating, and it is 1-866-687-7223. You can also reach us by email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and through a blog post, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to upcoming show menu. And then we're the first show with Bob Zimmerman. Open that page up. That is our archive page for this show. And then comments are all the way down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment or your question, I will get a copy of it, and I can bring it up on the show as quickly as possible or when the timing is more appropriate for it. So those are the three ways to reach us. But again, we prefer phones, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace at thespaceshow.com and the Space Show blog. And we do want to hear from you. So that is really the important part. Do remember that on our website, thespaceshow.com, there is the more comprehensive website newsletter, and it is uploaded fresh Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. So all of the programs are set and there for this week. So you can read what we have planned for Friday and for Sunday. And for Hotel Mars, that's still up in the air. So I don't know about that one yet for this week. That's why it says to be determined. And in addition, if you want to receive the very short email newsletter that we send out Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time, please send me your email address, and I'll be happy to add you to the list. If you want to get off of that list for one reason or another, ask me to take you off of it. Because if you unsubscribe through Constant Contact, you can never subscribe again. Those are their rules. So if you change your mind later on, I can't add you back into their into the mailing list. So if you want off, ask me to take you off, and hopefully you don't want off. And again, that email newsletter goes out at about 6 a.m. California time. It's very short. And if you have any questions or you want to subscribe to it, please let me hear from you. Everything we do is archived, so you can quickly download our programs or listen off of our website. Go to the upper left. We have a menu there. And under support, we have a store where you can get Space Show T-shirts and things of that nature. You'll see it as a Cafe Press store. Then we also have changes, as I've been talking about, to listen live. So we have the instructions for listening to a live show, a Space Show archive program, which is simply an MP3, a podcast, and some of the smartphone apps are listed, but not all of them. And a podcast is really just an MP3 in a different format. And then we're also set up to provide the Space Show in Alexa. For those of you that are using that, that is a really fast-growing part of the Space Show audience. And those of you who want to use Alexa, we have the TuneIn player embedded in that Listen Live app, so you can listen right there to Space Show podcasts. People that do it and use Alexa really swear by it, and they get great voice commands with it, and I can understand why they want to use it. I've never tried to use it. I don't have it, but it sounds like a pretty cool tool and toy at the same time. Over center right to the main page of the Space Show is Support the Space Show. So remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do financially support the Space Show. We're deeply appreciative of your support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a California deduction. Our parent nonprofit corporation is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out, and if you have any questions about our 501c3 status or our nonprofit or anything related like that, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have corporate sponsors, so you'll see their banner ads going across our homepage. Click on their banner ads from time to time. The sponsors do change their content, and I read a short statement for each sponsor because they are instrumental in bringing you the Space Show. So for the first segment tonight, the New Worlds Conference that I've been talking about is a sponsor, and that is November 10th through the 11th in Austin, Texas. It is part of the Austin County Fair. I guess that's what it's called, or the Austin State Fair, since Austin is the state capital. And their website for more information, newworlds2017, all one word, .space. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. That's their detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space, including Earth to orbit, reusable in-space transportation, Moon and Mars development, followed by a base in the asteroid belt, space settlements. Check it all out, and you can see it all laid out on their big poster-like graph that is at thespaceplan.com. The online plan is interactive, so if you click on any of the 500 elements, you get a lot more information, but you can buy a full-size copy in color of that poster. It is not interactive, but it is really cool. And if you have small children, they have an integrated space plan for kids. So all of this is available at thespaceplan.com. And finally, for the first segment, the Space Foundation is our sponsor. Their 34th symposium is just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th next year in Colorado Springs, and that is at the Broadmoor Hotel. And their website for that is spacesymposium.org. And there'll be more about the Space Symposium as we get closer to it. So as I said earlier, Bob Zimmerman is our guest tonight, so all of you know him. And if you've ever listened to any Space Show programs, I'm sure you've heard Bob, because he is the most frequent Space Show guest and the guest that has been on the Space Show more than any other guest. We used to have a running number on those appearances, but I've lost track of it. The number is so huge, I probably couldn't say it anyway. I'd have to write it out with all the zeros behind it. But check out Bob's blog, and I go to it sometimes twice a day. I have it saved on my iPhone, behindtheblack.com. It's not just really great space news, but it's all sorts of news and cultural things that are happening. And he has these really cool musical interludes or other kinds of cultural interludes, maybe a dance scene or something like that to break the news and to break you know, all the stuff that's breaking that we're sick of hearing about. So Behind the Black, and he does have all the latest space news. You'll stay in touch with everything. In fact, a lot of the space news that Bob has, you don't really find readily on other papers and other blogs and other pages. So again, it's Behind the Black. He's a noted author. We've talked with him about his books before. And time to talk to Bob and not talk about him.
Nah, you can keep going, David.
No. And tonight, guys, I really hope you call, because the last couple of times we've been coming up short on the phone calls, and I need your help.
The problem is I probably, the people who called before probably died of the experience.
Maybe. But
such an ogre, David.
Yeah, I need your help so I don't have to work so hard here to keep the show going. So when you guys call, it's like a little holiday for me. You know, I can go do a doobie or whatever, you know, in the background. And
come on, guys.
And,
do it for David.
And
let him rest.
I can get lost and call 911 to come rescue me like those people did in that high peak in the UK, you know, where they were so stoned they couldn't get down from where they got. I mean, what a world and what a West. The West is, I don't know, kind of is needs to see the dentist for a lot of decay and filling, I think. But that's not the subject of our show tonight.
No,
so, Bob, what I asked you before the show, I mean, I'm getting all these emails and people, we did an open line show last night and we had a gentleman call in from Virginia who was not bitten by the copperhead in the restaurant, but he had an idea for how Musk can finance his big Mars rocket, which he thought could be done through lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of reusable flights for orbital space tourism. We discussed that. But all of this is because Musk is going to lay out his big Mars rocket plan and revise what he did last year in Mexico to what he's doing this year in Adelaide, Australia. And for those of you who want to watch the live stream, I'm assuming you can do it at the IAC website or at the SpaceX website. The starting time, from what I've been told, is 2:30 p.m. Thursday afternoon, California time. So if you do want to watch it live, that's how you do it. Bob is already asleep. So
yeah, I'm sorry, David. I posted on Behind the Black about 2 weeks ago an essay I called Space Hype versus Reality. And in that piece, I used about four different examples of private companies. I didn't do government, but I could have included. I'll talk about government too. We have that with SLS, but I use four different examples to illustrate the importance of focusing on what has happened or is happening versus what is said to going to happen. And as much as I am, as people who followed me know, I am a real enthusiast for what Elon Musk and SpaceX has been doing. After his last hyped Mars speech, I'm far less enthusiastic about listening to him. Not that I don't think he's doing a good thing, and not that I disagree with him, but it is, to a certain extent, science fiction and fantasy and his dreams. And it's important to know those things, but right now there is so much reality actually happening that I'm not as much interested in this. I mean, there are some people like Richard Branson who's reached a point of no return. Until his company actually flies something, I'm really posting almost nothing about them, Virgin Galactic. But and Elon Musk is nowhere near that. He's reliable. When he says he's going to do something, he generally does. But in the coming to interplanetary travel, it was very clear from his last talk that he's a little over his head, and he's pushing something that he's not ready yet to do. And so, you know, I'm sure he'll update it, and I'm sure it'll actually be closer to reality. But I have other things on my plate that I think are more interesting.
So,
if I'm snoring all day.
So what if he comes out and he says our plan is going to be to fly tourists to orbital space stations and to the moon, and we're going to focus on getting our rocket technology and landing and whatever, you know, honed in and everything ready for the big push to Mars. Now, that's much more doable.
Oh, yes. And if he did that would be news, and that would be worthwhile, because then he would be talking about something that is a next step that his company is prepping, actually, to be able to do. Because they start launching the Falcon Heavy, and they make it operational, it gives them the capability to actually do that. And
So that would
Then, yes, I'd be much more interested in it. But it's impossible to hang on the words of everybody who makes proclamations. And at a certain point, I just say, all right, if someone else reports it, I'm a journalist and I try to recover what's going on, but I also recognize that it's impossible for me to be the first on everything. And even if I was, I would miss it. I'd miss some things. But so I'll report it like 2 or 3 hours after everybody else does then, and I'll be quite content because I'll give some analysis that others might not. I don't know what he's going to propose. I do know, it's interesting you mentioned, push towards tourism around the moon. It's interesting you mentioned that because I've been noticing in the news for the last 2 or 3 weeks a definite pattern coming from the White House and from the big space people, companies, and from the Russians, and from all the big government swamp, let me call it, because they have been really not accomplishing very much for decades in space. But nonetheless, they get lots of money, and so they have their plans. I've been sensing a pattern beginning to develop, and I think it is beginning to reveal where this large industry, this big government, big space industry is trying to go. They've been trying to influence Trump. It appears to me that they really have gotten to him and they're influencing him in a certain direction. And it strikes me that what I think is going to happen is that they're going to push Congress to fund a lunar orbiting station or a lunar Lagrange point station that's up near the moon in cislunar space, built by the big companies. They've proposed alternatives using SLS and Orion. And they're going to have it. They're going to try to push to get the first mission to begin building it with the third SLS Orion mission, which, by the way, is not funded and has never been determined. And there was a piece just this week where NASA has proposed exactly that for the third mission, which is to send Orion and modules to cislunar orbit to begin assembly of what they call the Deep Space Gateway, this space station in cislunar space. So I think that's what we're beginning to see. For example, they're going to have the first meeting of the National Space Council. The date was just revealed today by Pence for October 5th at the Air and Space Museum out near the airport in D.C., the big facility. They'll probably have the Space Shuttle Enterprise there in the background. It'll look great. They'll have lots of astronauts there. They'll have a lot of big names. This is not the National Space Council that has existed in the past, where they got together and discussed policy and then proposed the policy to the president. This is a public relations maneuver. It appears to me that the council is being set up to be a press operation to push policy. And I suspect that the speakers they're going to put together are going to propose a international project to head to the moon and build this deep space gateway. And they're going to be pushing we can do it by 2023, which is the date NASA proposed third mission.
Do you know who actually is a member of the National Space Council?
Yes, the report that I linked to just an hour or two ago about this listed the people who are on this council.
Who is it? I haven't seen your report yet.
Not realistic. All right, let me read the names to you. This first meeting, currently confirmed council members of the first meeting, include Pence. It includes the Secretary of State, Ray Tillerson. It includes the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. It includes the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross. The Secretary of Transportation, Elon Chao, the Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Elaine Duke, Office of Management and Budget Director, Mick Mulvaney, National Security Advisor, R.H. McMaster, the Director of National Intelligence, Daniel Coates, Acting National Administrator, Robert Lightfoot, the Deputy Chief Technology Officer of the United States, Michael Kratsios, and the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Paul J. Silver. These are all political appointees at the very top of basically the President's cabinet. And so most of whom know, I think, relatively little about the situation in the space business.
Yeah, they don't. Right, they're not space names at all.
No, they're not. They know very little. You know, this is not, I'm not trying to denigrate their knowledge of the areas. A lot of these are business people of some, this is what makes the Trump administration a little bit different. Some of these are business people who have been involved in things outside of government. But actually, this list is mostly a majority, not all, not even a most. Just the majority seem to be political appointees, part of Washington, not business people. And so what's going on here is this is a photo op for them. It's to talk about how wonderful big government will be, since you've got military and Homeland Security and transportation here. I expect they're going to be looking for pork, and that's why I think SLS is going to be the goal. And then it's a question of when Trump will have his his Kennedy-like speech announcing we're going to build a space station orbiting the moon by such and such a date. And he'll make that speech, as every president for the last 25 years has done. And as I mentioned on Behind the Black today, I'm very cynical about this because it's like this. I've seen this show many times before. The first act sounds great as it opens, but it withers away before the second act even starts. And that's what I expect to happen here to a certain extent. So I'm very cynical, and you mentioned this, and so I would... I hadn't thought about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if Elon Musk actually does announce that they're shifting their focus to the moon because there's money to be made there and it's a stepping stone to Mars. And they are going to offer, and this would be a good thing, they're going to offer the Falcon Heavy as an alternative, low-cost alternative, to make the Cislunar space station buildable at an affordable cost. And they do that, that'll get interesting then, and that'll be news. But we shall see. That's going to be a real mental challenge for Elon Musk, because his focus in everything he's done has always been Mars. And he would have to be conceding that Mars might not be happening as fast as he wants to do that.
What about Bridenstine? Does he fit into this yet, or he needs confirmation?
Oh, it's interesting. It's interesting you bring that up, because, I read that list to you of who's going to be there.
He's not there.
They have, for example, Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, and they have Acting
NASA
of an NASA Administrator.
Right.
You would have thought... But, he's not acting, so it would be difficult for him. I don't know how. They could have put him on the council. There's no reason why not.
Well, he's not been confirmed.
But it doesn't matter. He's a congressman. They could have put him on the council, right, and have him there. that would have been interesting. He's not. That's interesting to me. I don't exactly know. They haven't confirmed who's going to be speaking at this event. Once again, let me read. This meeting, entitled Leading the Next Frontier, an Event with the National Space Council, will include testimonials from expert witnesses who will represent the sectors of the space industry, civil space, commercial space, and national security space.
Well, no one from New Space is mentioned there.
The names I listed you were the council members, but that's not the people, give the expert witnesses. We don't know who the expert witnesses yet are.
So
they haven't announced that.
So we don't know who the speakers are.
No, we do not. These are the members of the council. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them aren't there for very long. They might just drop in for the photo op and disappear.
They haven't contacted me yet because I'm not preparing anything.
Haven't been contacted either. So. Commercial space. Once again, I don't know who's going to be there. This is a photo op opportunity. There's no question in my mind that's what's being set up here. And I hate to say it, but every indication I'm beginning to sense from the political Washington world is they're aiming to try to push for a international space station around the moon. Just in the last 2 weeks, the Russians have announced their plans of what they want to build in partnership with us around the moon. NASA just this week announced its new schedule for SLS and Orion, which included another 6 month to a year delay.
Right,
officially now that the manned mission won't happen in 2021. It's now set for 2022. even though the date that they have been working on is 2023, they said.
You know, I did a show with Lockheed about their gateway and their simulated HAB and,
okay,
and all of that and what they want to do. So they, and I was going to go see their HAB down at Kennedy, but we canceled out because of Hurricane Irma.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure that's going to be the Golden Boy project.
Yes, that's what it all appears to be pointing towards. They're going to get internet, the Russians in on it. That's what looks like they're aiming for right now. But it appears, at least initially, that NASA is trying to push SLS as the foundation stone for building such a thing. And that's where we get into tricky things, because it's very possible that the Trump administration might not buy into that. You know, if they're thinking of commercial space, by 2020, they're going to have at least one, likely two, viable competitive alternatives to SLS that are vastly cheaper and more operational.
Well, the Russians will be cheaper if they really are participants. They have rockets.
Yeah, but we're talking heavy lift here, and the only thing that could compare with SLS right now would be the Falcon Heavy and New Glenn, and those two rockets are likely to be operational before the first manned mission of SLS. And they will be operational at a tenth of the cost, and development time a third, if not less. You know, we're looking at a development time for the big rocket to launch the crew exploration vehicle that George Bush proposed in 2004. We're looking at a development time of almost two decades and more than $40 billion. And for to do one mission, that's to do the first mission, and that's just ludicrous. And the Russians can't provide the rocket, but you know, if Trump proposes we do this, go set up a space station around the moon, which I don't particularly think is a great idea, but I'm not against it. I'm not sure if it's if there was a profitable link to it, if you could make money on it as a tourist site, well then that makes some sense. But just as a stunt to government agent, you know, boondoggle, I'm not enthused. But if they propose to do it with open competition from companies to propose ideas so that NASA doesn't build it but buys the stuff from private enterprise, a competitive private enterprise, and then it might actually serve a good purpose. Right now, there's a real viable competitive launch industry that can conceivably provide the services to NASA. What we don't have at the moment is a viable competitive industry to build the facilities. They're very clearly working this up so that Lockheed Martin and the big companies team up to make it without competition. And that's where it'll be the boondoggle. So we'll see what happens. But that's where I think things are going right now. And it's what's going on partly is that the big government space sector is trying to figure out a way to survive in the new commercial, competitive, private enterprise launch market. And this is what they're proposing.
You have a listener question.
Sure.
Bob, this is Pete in Boulder, Colorado. He says, Bob, I don't understand this. Maybe you can explain it. Our relationships with Russia are in the tank and sinking lower and lower all the time, especially if you buy into what the mainstream press says in this country, or most press. What is so special about space that it escapes being in the tank? Why can we make an agreement with Russia to do something around the moon and that's not considered collusion? Why? Tell me, he's not through. Tell me again why space gets this special treatment with Russia when everything else with Russia, even if we might have a common interest with them, is in the sewer.
Well, we've got to remember that the whole thing with Russia and, quote, collusion was a political game being done by the press and the Democrats to harm Trump. It had nothing to do with reality. There was no evidence. There was nothing there. It was a total Potemkin village vaporware. It didn't exist. Van Johnson, who is a communist and an Obama appointee, and is also a regular guest on CNN, he admitted on videotapes it was a nothing burger. So that, put that aside for a minute. I don't pay much attention to that kind of junk. But Peter is 100% right. Why the fact that all the claims about sanctions against Russia and we've got to stop Russia from invading Ukraine, those are vaporware as well. That was from the Obama administration, but it's also from the Trump administration now. They're not serious about that. Those are just Potemkin Village claims to make it look like they're defending small independent countries that Russia is invading. The truth is, to them, space is space, and the big industry involved with it and the money involved is more important. And so they'll keep the partnership going. They have strategic reasons why they want to keep that partnership going, and so they will ignore the other issues. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, but they got rid of members of each embassy and consulate. I mean, that was real.
Well, yes, but that's, you know, those are symbolic acts. The reality is how much money is being poured into Russia instead of American businesses to put astronauts on ISS, and also how much money is American money is going to go to pay for the Russian modules that will be part of the Deep Space Gateway. Because I guarantee to you that the Russians aren't going to pay for that. They don't have the money. They are actually lobbying to be a partner in it because they want to see if they can get American money to pay for it. Essentially, they're acting as a contractor, and NASA's the customer. But why is NASA buying its product from Russia instead of American companies? There are plenty of American companies that can provide it for them.
Everyone wants an international partner. They think international is the way to go. So.
Well, yes, that's part of that. But that's, I think, a game, too. This has to do with just money. I don't think there's much sincerity with this whole thing about international cooperation will make us all live better and we'll all be, you know, we want to make the world sing. What was that Pepsi song? You know, that popular song. I'm very cynical about this, but I do think, you know, building a station around the moon might have some value from tourism perspective, but I'd much rather it was being built with the profit motive in mind instead of big government stunts, because we're more likely to get a practical, efficiently built, cost-effective space station orbiting the moon if profit was the full motive. Instead, international cooperation and real politic between these governments, which are routinely now very corrupt, makes me very suspicious of what we'll get. And when I say these governments that are corrupt, I include the federal government as well as the Russian government. There's corruption here. And this is not specifically attacking Trump, because that corruption is the same people who existed in the Obama administration. And there's a lot of people I named on this National Space Council who have been part of this. They use the political term that Trump came up with, the swamp. I could use the term that Ted Cruz came up with, the Washington cartel, but there's no question that this cartel, this swamp, is playing games to bring money in. They tried to stop my policy paper, Capitalism in Space, because I was making their SLS Orion boondoggle look really bad, and they didn't want that, and so they tried to squelch it, and they failed, but they tried very hard. And I see the same thing going on here. Once again, the cislunar station might have great value, actually, but I worry that it'll cost too much and take too long to build if we depend on these people to build it.
Do you think at all that there's any chance the gateway, I'm having a senior moment.
Deep Space Gateway.
Deep Space Gateway, thank you. I wanted to say the Lockheed Gateway, but that's not it. Well, maybe that is it. But
I wouldn't mind so much if it was Lockheed Gateway if they did it competitively with other offers, you know, more than one company. I know Orbital Sciences proposed something, but Orbital ATK, which is now going to become Northrop Grumman again, but their proposal, I think, is in conjunction with Lockheed Martin, I think. I could be wrong there. Anyway, go ahead, David. What were you going to say about
that? Is there any chance this could turn into a commercially influenced public-private partnership?
It could be. I mean, you bring up Elon Musk's speech. He's very shrewd politically. It's one of the things he's been successful at. He's focused on profit and private enterprise and doing it efficiently, but he's very shrewd at knowing how to manipulate the government to get out of his way or actually work with him. Not that he works with them, but to work with, that they work with him. In this case, they've been trying to get around him with this deep space gateway. I really think that, and SLS, but I think he might be trying that. He might make a proposal that will offer an alternative to SLS for this deep space gateway, and he's maybe going to do it before they make their big announcement. What is the date of his speech again, David?
Thursday, and it's going to be 2:30 p.m. California time, so that's Friday in Australia.
Okay, so it's this week.
It's
which
this
is
week,
a week
yeah.
earlier than the National Space Council's first.
Correct, yes.
So that's interesting. That's interesting timing. It's just interesting. There's a lot of speculation going on in this conversation, so I can't really, who knows what will happen. But I would say that, yes, you might get a more intelligent private-public partnership, especially if the public government insists upon real competition in building it and insists on low costs, doesn't let it become an SLS type boondoggle where cost is no object and time is no there's no limit on time and it could last for decades. No, they want it. We want to get it built. We want to get it built now. We want to make money from it as quickly as possible. If they do that, try to make money from it as quickly as possible for the private sector, then we would see something happen quick, and then it would be a good thing. I mean, totally a good thing, because private companies making money on this brings profit to the nation and innovation and gets us a spacefaring society.
Listeners, I do want to give out the number again in case you want to give us a call, because where are you? 1-866-687-7223 and email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. What else is happening? I got an email note today that there is a call for plans for Sierra Nevada's plane for missions and cargoes. Yeah, for Dream Chaser. So they're looking for some kind of call for projects or plans or missions for Dream Chaser.
This was a proposal sent out by Sierra Nevada.
Yeah, well, the email came from Sierra Nevada.
They're basically it's a request for proposals to use Dream Chaser for other things, essentially.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, that's they've been saying that from day one that this is the whole idea of the commercial space operation. The commercial companies own the vehicles and own the rockets, and they just provide the service to NASA. So if they build Dream Chaser, they're going to have a vehicle that they can offer to others, and so they're making that offer that's perfectly in line with that. They got to build it. They've been slow to get off the starting gate here.
Well, they didn't get money. They got technology help. So that's a little bit of a slowdown.
Yeah, I mean, they are apparently moving forward, and we should be seeing, hopefully, a real glide flight test of their engineering prototype in the next coming months. They've been promising this for, almost a year, more than a year. It's been almost, 2 years since they won the contract, and
uh-huh.
We haven't seen much. It's been actually very disappointing how little we've seen. But if they can make it happen, I'm all for it. I want that vehicle, because it would be a third option for getting people up to ISS, for getting cargo up to ISS, and inevitably they can upgrade to become a passenger vehicle. They build one, and if it flies a bunch of times successfully, they can build another. And then you have a fleet going of reusable ships. You put one of those on top of a Falcon 9, and then the only part that's not reusable is the second stage, which SpaceX has talked about possibly testing to reuse. And, that we're moving in that direction here. Hey, this is another story I have on Behind the Black about Arca Space, which...
I got their emails and their pictures of what they're doing with the
aerospike. Yeah, they are building a aerospike engine, a rocket that will be using an aerospike engine. And their aerospike engine is now on its test bed. They had a 60-day contract to get it up on the test bed ready to do static fire tests, and they met that contract. I mean, they're getting money from NASA to do this, but I think it's NASA. It might be DARPA, but they're getting money from the government to do this. But once they've tested this engine, they're going to put it on a demonstrator, suborbital demonstrator rocket, and they're going to fly an aerospike engine. They're going to test to see if it really works. If that works, they're going to start. Their goal is to build a single, because of the efficiency, the predicted efficiency of the aerospike nozzle engine, they say they'll be able to use that to build a single stage to orbit rocket for launching small sats. And they will be offering it to the small sat market, which is about to explode. And that will be significant because think about the words I said, single stage to orbit. It'll be a small rocket lifting small payloads, but it will not have stages. It will be completely single stage. That lowers the cost once again. And I would consider that to be almost as revolutionary a innovation as the first stage landings of SpaceX and reusability of their first stages. So that's it. That's interesting. That's once again part of this small sat. Rocket Labs is getting ready for an October launch of its second flight of Electron. They're going to put some commercial satellites on it. They say that if that launch goes well, they made no changes engineering-wise to the rocket after the first test flight. The failure was not the rocket. It was miscommunication between them and a third-party contractor, and they say they fixed that. And their next flight, if it goes well, they say they might forego a third test flight and move directly to commercial operations. And that, of course, is important to Moon Express because they're trying to win the Google X Prize and they need this rocket to launch to do it. But it's also significant for the small sat market because there's lots of nanosats out there that need a rocket to launch them. And Rocket Lab looks like it's going to be first in line to do it.
So are you following Google Lunar X Prize? Do you think anyone's going to win it this year?
Well, no one's going to win it this year. I take that back. If Rocket Lab's October test flight works, maybe they will try this year. But the Google X Prize extended the deadline from the end of this year to March about a month ago. And it was very clear to me the reason they did that is they've got five finalists right now, all of whom got launch contracts, but all of whom have issues of some kind or another that makes meeting the end of the year deadline difficult, if not impossible. So what they've done is they reordered the deadline to March because that extends the window just enough to probably make at least one, if not four of these contestants, if not all five, viable and have the time to get done what they need to do. And so I think by early next year, we might finally see some of these launch. It could happen before the end of the year. Once again, if a Rocket Lab gets its second launch off and it's good and they move to commercial operations, Moon Express would be the next launch, I think, and they would try to go as soon as they can. So they might go by December, but I think more likely January. India has a contract with two of the contestants using their PSLV rocket. And they had a failure about a month and a half ago of the PSLV rocket, and that was like the first failure in years. It's been a very reliable rocket, and it's been their mainstay commercially. It's not a powerful rocket, but it's powerful enough to put the small rovers to the moon. Well, they have a contract. The two different contestants have a contract to go on the same PSLV rocket, and India, I think influenced by the competitiveness of the launch industry, when they had that failure in the past, it would be years before they'd launch again, just like NASA would take years to recover from a shuttle accident. This time, they said, a month later, we're going to launch by December. We're going to be back in operations by December. In other words, they're going to move quickly to figure out what went wrong, fix it, and go back to launching. There's no reason to take years to investigate such a thing. And so I think that the competitiveness is influencing them. But what it means, too, is they're trying to service their customers, the two people who want to get Moon Express, their Google Lunar X Prize rovers to the moon. And so that's three of the competitors right there. And then these are the ones off the top of my head that I think are most viable competitors for the good prize. And they all, you know, the India launch would be the most interesting because if it launches, you're going to have two different rovers, two different competitors on it, and they will literally be flying to the moon neck and neck and then landing on the moon neck and neck. And then they have to complete 500 meters of travel neck and neck and broadcast data back, you know. So it would literally be a race if that becomes the first one to launch. So, yes, I'm following it. It's kind of cool, and it's private enterprise. It's best, you know.
Can't you see something like the Ben-Hur race where one rover starts sticking out a claw to screw up the other rover?
They're probably going to land very far apart from each other.
Oh, I can just see something like that Ben-Hur chariot race from the movie. You know, they're not going to...
We might get that far someday, but I don't think in this game.
We're not going to let you win.
That happens down the road. Not yet.
We're not going to let you win. So we'll see. Do you see anything happening that might be exciting or noteworthy before the end of the year? I mean, we're down to October now.
Well, I've been one of the things I've been doing is I've been following the it's beginning to be almost like sports, following the launch race per year, who is going to launch the most rockets in the year. And last year I posted a graph detailing the launch, all the launch companies and nations for the year. And it was also a graph that went back about a decade, showing, you know, so you could track who's been going up and down for the last decade or so. I've been keeping track of that, and right now it is really interesting to see how the trends have been shifting. It does appear that the U.S. is about to, maybe this is a poor choice of words, but explode into the launch market and become dominant. We haven't been a leader in launches since the late 90s during the dot-com boom, when they thought lots and lots of communication satellites were going to be lost, and there were a lot of launches for that short period of time, and we were the leader in the world in launches for a period of 2 or 3 years in there. But since then, we have not been a dominant launch nation, and Russia has been dominant. And in the last few years, very slowly, very quickly, China has been creeping up to be competitive. They basically were neck and neck with the U.S. last year. Depending on how you define the launches, they either just lost to us in the number of launches or tied with us last year. And Russia had a very bad year, the worst year probably in decades last year, because of the corruption that they discovered in one of their engine factories that literally was required them to recall all rocket engines so they could check them all. However, they have recovered from that, and this year the U.S. is dominating. We've got already 20 launches for the year, which just about ties last year. I don't know the exact number. Maybe we're one short, but just about ties last year already. Last year we tied more or less with China. China has only got 7 launches so far this year, and that's because they had a failure in June with one of their smaller rockets, and then their Long March 5 big rocket on its second launch failed. And they've launched nothing since that July failure. And it appears they will launch nothing until the Communist Party Congress is over in October. Because they don't want to have any launches take place before that and have a failure. They lose face. And that's generally how communist top-down governments work. The government is not going to be embarrassed by a failure. And since the government runs their space program, no launches. But that means that they had hoped to be tops in the world or close to it. Instead, they're way down. Russia has recovered. Russia is now ahead of space. It just moved ahead this month, moved ahead of SpaceX for the most number of launches. So Russia is at least matching a single American company. They're not matching the U.S. at the moment because we have multiple companies that are launching. But they are at least matching SpaceX, or at least ahead of them at the moment. They have recovered. They've already done 14 launches this year. It looks like they're going to be matching last year's. Now, that's also a low number for them over the decades. But it is a number that is being established by a lot of launches after the first half of the year. They did very few launches the first half of the year because they were recovering from the engine recall. But since they have, fixed that, apparently, they've been doing a lot of launches, at least 2 to 4 a month. And so they've caught up to SpaceX and they're pushing hard. So it's an interesting thing to see the space race in terms of launch companies and nations, over the next few years. I pushed that graph back to 86, so you can really see the trends, and I'll be publishing that at the end of the year. You can really see the trends that have happened over time, how the U.S. has shifted from government to private enterprise in the last decade and a half. And you can see how other nations have shifted up and down. And it's indicative of what's coming down the road, because I think that the nations I've mentioned, the U.S., China, Russia, who've been the big players, are not going to be alone anymore. We're going to start to see India, Japan enter the race and become players and significant players in this. And then they won't be the only ones. I haven't even mentioned Europe. I shouldn't leave them out. They're a major player here, and they're trying to compete. So it's going to be, we have a real space race going on here. It's for profit, it's for territory, it's for power, and it's for the future. And all these nations and companies are vying for a piece of the pie, which it's going to be really exciting to see it unfold in the coming decades.
You have another email from John is in Denver.
Okay.
It looks like Colorado is active tonight. Is there anything new from your vantage point with the push for property rights and outer space treaty reform? What's happening on that and on an international level? And by the way, Bob, I met a guy at a Space Foundation financial meeting in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and then he subsequently called me on the phone, and he told me there were a series of UN meetings coming up with COPUS to talk about modifying or redoing or somehow changing the Outer Space Treaty. And there was one coming up, I think, in October or November this year, and another one in the spring of next year in the UAE. And then they were going to put a policy statement out with suggestions for how to change or modify or issue amendments or whatever to the Outer Space Treaty, because there's a big interest and a big concern in the deep space mining things, what's happening, the property rights debate, on and on and on. And yet the people I've gone to don't know anything about this series of meetings.
Well, they're not paying attention. I've been paying attention.
So it is for real. They are.
Oh, yes, there is for real. And what's happened is that in the last 2 years, and partly mostly led by the United States, actually instigated by the United States and the government's concern, the concern within the Congress that property rights are not properly protected by the legal situation created by the Outer Space Treaty. So the U.S. Congress has been trying to come up with solutions, and that's kind of helped instigate the conversation. Other countries like Luxembourg, really important what Luxembourg's done here, because Luxembourg wants to become a major investor and profit taker in asteroid mining. But their government, which is kind of like a venture capitalist in this industry, it's a very unusual situation, but their government has told their space ministers that, guys, you haven't come up. They tried to set up a legal framework, and the government, the legislature basically told them, guy, you haven't solved the Outer Space Treaty property rights situation. You've got to come up with a policy that will allow property rights in space, and your policy statement doesn't really do it. We have to address the Outer Space Treaty itself. And the UAE, you mentioned them, they're going to have a meeting there. They are trying to become a player. They're trying to diversify their economy by making space a major issue. This has to do with one of their sheikhs, major player there is really a space cadet, and he thinks this is a really great way to do it, and I'm not going to argue with him. I think he's right. But because of that, they're pushing very hard to become a major player in commercial space, and they are trying to put together their own space strategy and policy, and have discovered the same thing that Luxembourg discovered and the United States discovered, that the Outer Space Treaty does not allow for property rights, a firm, solid protection of property rights in space. And so they've been talking about a need for this, and Japan has recognized it now, so has the United Kingdom. And so these nations are raising it at the UN. And so it does not surprise me at all that this is happening. Will they make a decision that will be beneficial for true private enterprise? I will be cynical because this is a swamp, a cartel to protect their own interests. But if they create law that protects property rights and allows the establishment of property rights by whoever gets there, well, then, you know, that kind of opens it up to a wider market, and it makes it bottom up. It makes it the companies and the people who do the work actually will own what they do. And so I'm hopeful. I've gotten hints along these lines. I've also gotten hints that the establishment has kind of circled its wagons to try to defend the situation here that presently exists, saying that the Outer Space Treaty does not need to be changed. And so there is a battle, an internal battle going on within the global international community, government community, about dealing with this issue. But it is not a problem that's going to go away. And since the money increasingly is coming from private enterprise to do things in space, I think the pressure to solve the problem will grow over time.
But most countries that have signed the OST don't have any commercial space and don't want to be left out. So my hunch is they would not be so willing to modify that kind of an OST.
That's the first reaction everyone has, including myself. But what I see happening within the nations that are trying to get into space, and they carry the most weight in this matter, they are all shifting. Every single one of them appear, except for maybe Russia and China, who really don't care about this issue, but everybody else is shifting in a direction towards protecting private property in some manner, creating some manner to allow private property to exist in space, and also trying to figure out how do we establish law in space, because the Outer Space Treaty does not allow that. You can't claim territory, which means no nation's sovereignty will be applied to any territory. Well, that means there is no sovereignty and there's no legal system. You know, how do you establish legal systems in space? It's not established. There's no rules for it. How do you establish borders, property lines? Just property lines. Forget about borders. You can't do it. And so you need to have some kind of framework for doing that. And every nation that's getting involved in space is moving in that direction. For example, Australia this week, just yesterday, announced they're going to create their own space agency. And this is something that they haven't had for the last half century. They basically followed England's, Great Britain's lead in the late 60s and decided they will spend no government money on space. And so they've had nothing for decades. They haven't had much of a space industry, neither did England, Great Britain in all that time. Great Britain about 2 years ago created its own space agency and initially was going to become like a big NASA operation, but they shifted. And they shifted towards trying to encourage competition and private enterprise. Now, Australia has not said what their strategy, what that space agency is going to do, but they said that in the process of forming it, they're going to write a charter and they're trying to figure out what their strategy will be in the context of commercial space and profit. They said that. So I think the countries that are getting involved in this are all shifting in that direction. India is a good example of that as well. And so, I'm hopeful that the countries that are in space will have more influence in the writing of these documents. Having said that, I also have said that this is there's power play here, and they're going to want to protect their interests, and so we're going to see how it plays out. I alternate between optimism and stark pessimism here. And
do you know how many countries have to approve amendments or modifications to the treaty?
You know, that's a good question. I could probably look that up pretty quick. It's probably, without looking it up, my guess would be that it's going to require a majority vote of all the signatories, or it'll be a treaty amendment that nations have to, and this is more likely actually, it'll be a treaty amendment that nations have to sign on to. And so each nation's rules on how they accept the treaty will take effect. So if there is an amendment to the Outer Space Treaty, it's going to be put forth, the language will be put forth, and then it'll be presented by the president to the Senate, and the Senate's going to have to say yay or nay. And the other countries, however they do that, would be how that would, you know, how that would be, they'd accept it. That's generally how they've done things in the past. They would introduce new language, and each nation has to decide whether they wish to accept it or not.
Well, does it become valid with only a few nations accepting it?
Yeah, now you're getting into areas I can't answer right off the top of my head. I'd have to do some research. I'm on the Outer Space Treaty website now, but I'm going to have to dig here, and I don't think I can do this while I'm on the phone with you, but I do not know how updates or changes will be made. It wouldn't surprise me that the very people who write the changes will also negotiate how those changes will be accepted. And they might be on a treaty-to-treaty basis. So it could be, they're going to propose a change which will not be valid unless a majority of the nations who have signed on have done. You know, they could set up their own rules, I'm guessing. But I don't know the answer to that question. I have to research it. It's a good question, though.
Is the Trump administration likely to want to sign an amendment to the Outer Space Treaty, or only if it protects property rights?
I don't know. You know, the policy of the Trump administration is sometimes a little hard to determine. I've been watching them Trump and how he's done things really coolly with a analytic eye. I'm not getting into this resistance and he's a fascist and all that crap. He's a former liberal Democrat, New Yorker, who has shifted and become somewhat more conservative in his later life. And the Democrats have done everything they can to antagonize him, so he keeps moving more to the right. His actual policy as president, and this relates to the Outer Space Treaty, his policy and president has been very mixed from a conservative perspective, and therefore from a liberal conservative, it's been very mixed. For example, when it comes to environmental regulation and government bureaucracy, he's been extremely effectively hostile to that. He is reshaping how the EPA functions so it's no longer a regulatory machine with the only goal is to stop to protect the environment. He's reshaping it to be a little bit more pro-business, and I think that's a positive thing. He's trying to bring it back to its original roots. It got out of control as an agency, I think, and that applies to the entire green political framework. I think he's bringing some reasonability to that, and he's pushing back against what I think had been an out of control bureaucracy. But in other areas, such as the federal deficit and others, he's not so good. He's definitely been for more spending. For things like health care, he's been mixed. And, you know, I'm taking this from a conservative perspective. Other people could disagree with me. But, you know, once again, it's a mixed bag. So when you talk about the Outer Space Treaty and property rights, it's a little hard to say. You know, for example, I talked about how I think we might be seeing Trump make the Kennedy-like speech about building a space station around the moon. That would be old-fashioned Washington establishment way of doing things, which just brings boondoggle pork to districts. But if he makes the announcement and says he wants a competition from launch companies to provide the services instead of just using SLS, well, that puts a whole different color to the announcement. What will he do? I can't answer the question right now because he's been so mixed. It's unpredictable what he will propose. It's very clear that the big players in big space are pushing for a big space, big boondoggle project from the federal government and from Trump. But there's enough to indicate that might not be what they'll get, and we'll have to see. And predicting what Trump will do is, at this stage of the game, a little hard to do. Oh, I don't try to predict his actions. I try to watch what he's actually doing. Remember, this gets back to my whole thing about space hype versus reality. I'm not interested in what he says often, because what he says sometimes is for effect, and it's a negotiating ploy, and it sometimes has nothing to do with what he'll do. I pay very close attention to what his administration is actually trying to do. And in this case, I don't know what they'll do, but I'm going to be watching to see what it is and what they announce. You know, for example, if this outer space, this National Space Council is going to have this meeting, and it's going to be a PR push. that doesn't necessarily tell us what the Trump administration is going to actually do. It tells us what certain players in the Washington establishment want the Trump administration to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean Trump will do what they want. We'll just have to wait to find out.
Listeners, let me give out the phone number. I'm surprised that nobody wants to call us tonight.
Oh.
1-866-687-7223. I don't know that there's any big sports events that we're conflicting with, but
no, the sports events they're all too busy spitting on the American flag, so they don't there's nothing else for us to talk about there. Do you want to take a? I don't know. We've been on for an hour, Dave. Do you want to take a break?
Do you need one?
No, I can keep going, but usually you do in an hour, so.
Well, sometimes I do. Sometimes I
keep going.
I don't. If you need one, I'll take one. But otherwise, I have a couple of emails to
read here.
Sure,
let's go with those.
So Beth is in Portland, Oregon, with a question, and Beth says we don't hear very much about human spaceflight. For the new space, we mostly hear about rocket launches, small rocket launches, satellites of various different types, and then we hear a lot about the NASA big planetary missions, like the headlines in the news about the demise and the end of Cassini, which was certainly a great long-lived mission. Do you see any other kinds of activities, either on the planetary side, coming up soon that might be as exciting as Cassini? Do you see anything at all on the human side? I mean, all we hear about is space tourism, but it never seems to go anywhere.
All right. Well, first on the planetary side, there are planetary missions out there that are going to be arriving in different places soon, and there'll be exciting events when those happen. You're going to have New Horizons on January 1st, 2019, flying past a Kuiper Belt object, and that will be looking at an object we've never seen, a type of object we've never seen before, so I guarantee it will look like nothing we've ever seen. And just Friday, or was it Thursday? Yeah, it was Friday, Ceres Rex flew past the Earth to get a gravitational boost to slingshot it towards the asteroid Bennu. And that's a mission to, it's going to arrive in 2018, next year, at Bennu. It's going to grab a sample and bring that sample back to Earth, an asteroid sample back to Earth. Bennu is an interesting asteroid because it is a potentially dangerous asteroid. Sometime in the next, I think, two centuries, it could conceivably, depending on what happens in its orbit, it has the potential of colliding with Earth. So knowing a lot more about Bennu would be a very wise thing for us down the road. And so that's interesting, and that's going to be getting into the news next year. When it comes to human flight, I'm not going through all the planetary stuff here, but the shift to the human flight, we are still in that transitional period between the end of the shuttle and the emergence of commercial competing space companies. NASA has tried to put roadblocks in front of the two commercial companies that are building capsules for NASA, and there's politics involved with why they're doing that.
Why would they do that? They're the ones who want the capsules.
Well, you got to remember, NASA is not a monolith. There are different people with different agendas within the agency and influenced by big contractors that the agency hires. And even within those contractors, like Boeing, they have conflicts within the company itself. They know the people, Boeing and Lockheed and all the big contractors are all participating in the building of SLS and Orion, and they all are making a lot of money from it. They're dependent on that. It's almost like an addiction, that heroin. They're dependent on it, and so they want to protect it. And they know that if the private sector companies get their capsules launched and operational, and their big rockets launched and operational before SLS does its first manned mission, they're gonna look, SLS is, and those big companies are gonna look really bad, and competitively they will be in a very weak sales position. And so they have been actually doing, I think, what they can to try to prevent the commercial manned capsules from launching ahead of SLS. And one of the ways they, I think they've been doing it is pushing using their influence on NASA's safety rules to slow those companies down. And the reason I'm cynical about this and have no faith that safety is really the reason behind these issues is because while they slowed Boeing down, made Boeing make a lot more parachute tests than were necessary. Boeing's using a parachute system that's been in use since the 60s. They know how to do parachutes out of a capsule. There's no reason to do multiple tests, but NASA forced that on them. At the same time, NASA announced that they are going to launch the second SLS mission with people on board, and that mission is going to be using a second stage that will have never flown before. And that, of course, breaks all the rules, safety rules, that they're imposing on the two private companies. And the reason that they're ignoring, they're waiving that safety violation is because if they had to fly a second unmanned test flight, they wouldn't have enough money to fly the manned mission. And they don't have enough money. They have no funding after the first two missions. So that kind of forced, and they would also delay that manned mission probably another year or two. And that also, once again, makes them look really bad compared to the commercial companies. And so there's a game being played here to try to protect the big money that's going to the big contractors for SLS and Orion. It's been a gravy train now since 2004. $3 billion a year. It was $3 to $6 billion a year because it's, depending on the state of the contracts, Lockheed Martin's gotten anywhere from $3 to $1 billion a year for Orion. And then Constellation to transitioning to, SLS gets about $3 billion a year for that, and that's been going on since 2004, 2005. And it's a lot of money. And so they're trying to protect it. And so that's the game being played there, and you got to be aware of it. Now, in terms of human flight, this is going back to Beth's question, what will happen the next few years is I think that all those obstacles are going to fade away and eventually get pushed aside, and both Boeing and Lockheed Martin will launch their private capsules and people will fly again on American rockets. And when that starts happening, you will hear about manned space again. And it once again will be a nail in the coffin for the very expensive and not flying Orion SLS system.
So where does that put Blue Origin and Virgin with suborbital space?
Well, put Virgin out. Virgin is not a player here. Just put them. We shouldn't even be putting them in the same words. They have nothing to do. Virgin Galactic is a boondoggle. Is not a boondoggle. It's been a fraud up to now. They have to prove themselves, and I don't believe anything coming out of that company's mouth until they actually do something. And Virgin Orbit is a small sat launcher. It's a separate thing entirely, having to do with manned space. The two companies that matter are SpaceX and Blue Origin. And Blue Origin is part of this game because Blue Origin, you got a owner of that company, Jeff Bezos. He's, without even making a dent in his stock control of Amazon, he can sell stock and earn $1 billion cash a year, which he's devoting to Blue Origin. So that company has very deep pockets. Now, $1 billion a year in the government is not a lot of money, but for a private company that does things smart and efficient, it's a god-awful lot of money. And so Blue Origin is not going to go away. They are going to build Duke Glenn, and it's going to be a competitive rocket that will be a heavy-lift rocket that will be competitive with Falcon Heavy, and both of them will make SLS look like ridiculous. And totally unworthy of giving a dime to. And so those two, and once again, New Glenn is a heavy lift rocket. It's maybe not as powerful as SLS, but it's a big rocket, able to put a lot of tonnage in orbit. When you put a lot of tonnage in orbit, it gives you capability of putting people in orbit. And then the capsules will exist. So, you know, we'll have possibly Dream Chaser as a manned vehicle eventually. We'll have Dragon capsules that are manned and potentially reusable. And you'll have Starliner capsules. And all of them could go on these two rockets. And so That's the kind of excitement I expect to start happening around 2020. And it's going to be a space race there, while I talked up to now about a space race between, SpaceX and Russia and the various nations of the world competing for space. Within the United States, we have a space race between the giant government SLS Orion and the many different private companies. And just like the Cold War, picking the winner there is a no-brainer. The only way SLS and Orion can win is coercion. They force taxpayers to pay a lot of money to those operations. If anyone had to buy that service freely, voluntarily, no one would, because it's just too expensive.
You have a NASA budget question by email. And
okay.
Tina is in the Chicago area, and she says, it appears that NASA actually does fairly well in the budget suggestion, but who knows what the budget will be, and it will come and go and not be approved by September 30th at the end of our fiscal year. So I guess we go forward as we have gone forward in all years before. So what do you see, Bob, for a budget resolution, and do you think NASA takes some hits or continues about where it is in the suggested range?
It's going to go about where it is in what's been proposed by the Trump administration and proposed by Senate and then proposed by the House. There have been differences, but nothing has been significant between the three of them. The problem with that is that all three are continuing to fund SLS and Orion. I sound like I'm really hating SLS and Orion, but I really do. I think that $4 billion they spend a year on that could be much better spent on other things. And I really wish they would. It's a boondoggle. It's not going to accomplish anything. But in terms of NASA's overall budget, the recommendations by both Trump administration, House and Senate have been generally either holding the situation to where it is or actually been favorable. For example, Congress, I have to do this off the top of my head, so I'm not getting one of the houses of Congress was very favorable to planetary program and is trying to reinstate a lot of spending that was cut by the Obama administration. Planetary program is one of NASA's most successful areas, and it's been trimmed significantly is sad. That's the kind of money that SLS, I would much rather be spent on than SLS, put it into the planetary program. Fact, we have a gigantic federal debt and deficit. I think it would be very possible for NASA to actually have its budget cut by about $2 billion, and it could accomplish a lot more. And from my perspective, as an American, I want some attention be paid to the debt. And I'm quite willing to have NASA's budget cut significantly if you then focused putting the money where the bang is the best. And that's where I come from. And it's pretty clear, if you've been listening to me for the last hour and a plus, where I think we should cut and where the money could be spent better.
Well, weren't the Republicans supposed to reduce the spending and the deficit?
Well, they're not. They're part of that corrupt Washington establishment that really doesn't want to change anything. The public is, I think, most of the nation, I think, is pretty clear. They want some control over the federal government. It's not achieving. The federal government, not only is it putting us in terrible debt, it's not doing any of its jobs very well. Almost any federal agency you want to talk about, anyone who has any direct experience with those federal agencies knows they generally don't do a very good job, or they do a really bad job, almost up and down the line. And I could talk about NASA here as well. Even though their planetary program is really pretty successful, I could point out many areas where this could be done a lot better and cheaper. And so the public wants some control over this, but the people in charge in Washington, they don't want that because there's money to be made. Their donors are not the American people. Their donors are people in Washington who want to get money to them, like the big space companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, the big corporations. They want to keep that money flow coming to those companies, and so they pay the politicians to support them. And Trump said he'd clean this all out, but once again, there's a mixed bag of what he's doing. In some areas, yes, he is doing it. In other areas, and I think space will be one of them, he ain't doing it.
Well,
We'll see.
They've had 7 years to craft a repeal of Obamacare, whether you agree with that or not, and those doofuses can't even do that. Now, that's not Trump's fault.
No, that isn't Trump's fault. But that's, once again, I'm not trying to blame this on Trump. I'm pointing out that the establishment in D.C. from either party is not really interested in what the American people have been asking.
Things. You have a note from Sweden. So one of the most socialist empires in the world today. So this is our friend Bijan, who you have communicated with before. I would like you to comment again on the Deep Space Gateway. So let me read the whole thing, okay?
Yeah.
Do you think that it will happen? Wouldn't it mean a reduction of human spaceflight by about 99% compared to the space station? The DSG can only be visited once every second year, a couple of weeks at a time, since the SLS cannot launch Orion more than even that, and the DSG serves no useful purpose. Now, that, of course, is his idea. If he listened to the Lockheed show, that's not what he would come away with, but that's what he says. So your comment.
Well, okay. Once again, his point is well taken about getting flights to it, but he assumes it will only be SLS to do it. And that's where the unknown is here from the Trump administration. It could very well, we're going to have to see how this unfolds. If the Trump administration uses the Deep Space Gateway, I hate acronyms, I always use the full word or a word like the gateway. If the Trump administration wants to use the gateway as a ploy to keep SLS and Orion funded, and they want to only use SLS and Orion, then his point
he's
100% right.
Right.
It's a stupid idea. We will hardly visit it. We'll never get anything accomplished. It's just basically going to be a money train to these big companies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If the Trump administration says, we want to build this, but we're going to need multiple launchers to do it, and we're going to put it out for bid who can put the habitats up, and we're going to put it out for bid who can design the best habitats and for the best cost, then we might have something more interesting, because then you might be able to, because, you know, like Falcon Heavy, for example, and New Glenn, they're both designing these as commercial rockets that will launch on a regular basis. And Falcon, and both of them are reusable, partly reusable with their first stages. So what you've got there is a viable launch system that could put up crews to this Deep Space Gateway, not once every year and a half to two, but on a regular shuttle basis, just like ISS. And so the big key question is how this proposal, this Kennedy-like proposal I'm expecting to come from Trump, how it is going to be framed. How does Trump propose making it happen? And that's the key question. We don't know the answer to that now. It's very clear that there are political forces lobbying different approaches right now. And this might be the one reason to listen to Trump, to Elon Musk's speech, because if he does talk in that direction, then we're going to see exactly the political landscape playing out on trying to influence how this project is proposed.
Well, and Musk is a smart player. He may sense this as a real opportunity for some cash flow.
Yes. I did say that earlier tonight.
Right.
Yeah, so you're right, David. But, you know, once again, we're going to have to see how it plays out. He's a smart player, but it doesn't mean he has the influence. Remember, like this National Space Council and the people involved in it, you know, all the people, this is something that Eric Berger pointed out on Ars Technica. When they announced Pence as the head, and Trump signed the authorization to recreate the National Space Council, Eric Berger noted that all the people there were from the big contractors. There was nobody like Elon Musk there. And similarly, this National Space Council looks like it's going to be bringing in people from the big space companies. Elon Musk, meanwhile, is making a speech in, where is it, Australia?
Right, Adelaide.
You can't get farther away from Washington, you know.
Adelaide, so, Australia.
Well, the point I'm making, though, is that he's like an outsider here, and he's trying to influence them from the outside. And he might succeed, but there's a lot of money. There's the stories I could tell about getting Capitalism in Space published and how those big companies tried to squelch it, David. I mean, that publication was delayed by almost 8 months because they tried, they did not want what I'd written published because it makes SLS and Orion look really like a bad deal, like it's really not getting good money for our investment. And they did not want that in print. And they worked very hard to try to squelch it. And they were using their money and power to try to do that.
Excuse me, Rich is in New York with an email for you.
Okay.
And he said, Musk has recently been in the news, but not for space activity, but for being one of the business advisors that has revolted and left the Trump team because of the Trump comments over Charlotte. My question is, Trump and Musk are both political players. Do you think that what Musk did by getting out of that high-powered business committee over Trump's Charlotte comments via Twitter have anything to do with distancing himself from space with the Trump administration, or does he believe space will be untouched, much like it is with the Russian relationship?
That's a really good question from Rich. I hadn't even thought about that. But it is very possible that one of the reasons I'm sensing SLS Orion winning the political battle in the Trump administration, that's at least my sense right now, and could very well be because Elon Musk, for foolish reasons, because what was being accused of Trump and his Charlotte tweets was just absurd.
Yeah, totally. I agree with you on that.
So for foolish reasons, he pulls out of that committee and he takes himself away from a position of influence. And at the same time, possibly antagonizes Trump, who is a... You know, who's sensitive to these kind of things responds.
He holds a grudge.
Yeah, he can hold a grudge. And so it could very well have been a politically foolish move on Elon Musk's part, especially because the accusations against Trump were completely false. And so to leave that business council based on false accusations makes Trump look really bad. It definitely works against him in this political game. And I think that's a really good question. Now, in the long run, it could very, you know, this is still politics. And in politics, those kind of, you know, Trump, for example, Elon Musk leaves the business council because of Charlottesville. But then a few months pass, and I completely forgot about it, and so do most other people. And then here you get Elon Musk is going to, let's assume that he's going to make a proposal that he wants to be part of the space tourism deep space gateway. Well, it's politics. People might completely forget about that down the road, you know, and how can it benefit them politically? And this includes Trump, and they'll play the game depending on how it can benefit them all politically or financially. And so it could be that was just a one moment politically correct statement by Elon Musk that makes him feel good and makes his fans feel good. And he avoids bad publicity for a short while from the politically illiterate crowd about what happened in Charlottesville. And then he can just go his merry way.
Well, and what you don't know is what Musk is still consulting and doing with the administration under the table and behind the scenes.
Public announcement he's off the council, but does that mean he's no longer talking to Trump? You want to bet?
I doubt it.
That's not the case.
I doubt it.
It's a political game.
He's too smart a player.
This is why I really pay more attention to what people do than what they say. What they predict they're going to do means a lot less to me than what they actually do. And so, you know, that announcement he's leaving the business council, well, it has some influence, and it could actually, you know, have worked against Elon Musk. But the bottom line is what they end up doing. And so until we hear the actual proposal on this from the Trump administration, but what NASA policy is going to be, we really don't know where they're going.
Well, it's two days. You have to wait 2 days. Here, Bijan in Sweden has another comment for you.
Yes.
Follow-up. The deep space gateway requires the Orion docked to it, according to a recent Lockheed Martin presentation on the FISO teleconference series. And only the SLS can launch the Orion to lunar orbit. Obviously, the only purpose of the project is to consume SLS launchers. It will particularly end human spaceflight for the next quarter of century. Well, that is his opinion, which, of course, he's obviously entitled to.
Yeah, I think he's making certain premises. For one thing, it's not that difficult. I mean, I would question, I don't know this for a fact, but I would question that docking mechanism is not similar to what's being used on, or compatible to what's being used on ISS for both Dragon and Starliner. I would question that. I think they're almost certainly, I don't know this for a fact, that's why I'm qualifying it, but I'd be shocked and really, I would not expect them not to be compatible. That's for one thing. And secondly, that's an easy fix because the docking port can be changed pretty this is not advanced cutting edge science here. This is something they know how to do. And so if the cost effective, if you're going to save, for example, if you're going to be able to launch three times a year for third the cost of SLS, well, you're saving then $1.5 billion. Well, you can invest $300 million and get the docking port changed, and you still come out ahead. So I don't see that as a big obstacle. Once again, that from a practical point of view and a common sense practical point of view, there, that's not a big obstacle. The politics here is the unknown. We don't know where they're going to go. That's the unknown. And our Swedish analyzer here could be 100% right that they're focusing on creating a goal for SLS to justify the money stream, and that they don't really care if we accomplish anything in space at all. They haven't cared for almost two decades now in building SLS and Orion. It's just keep that money stream going. And so it could very well be that's the case. But the difference between the last two decades and now is that we now have competition, other alternative choices. And in the end, SLS and Orion will not be an obstacle because they won't be the way we'll do it. We'll do it with private companies.
Listeners, we're at the 90-minute point, which is actually what space shuttle programs are supposed to be.
They never are, not with me.
Well, they never are with anyone. We either do a 60-minute format show if the guest is short of time or if for some reason I've had a dentist or doctor appointment that I've had to deal with, or a vet appointment. Poor Pepper sometimes needs attention. I shouldn't call her poor. She's a very lucky dog. So if you do want to give us a call. Your time is now no longer unlimited. So pick up the phone and give us a dial at 1-866-687-7223. If some of you are overseas and you're just dying to talk to Bob, there's two ways to do that. So one is, this is an MCI toll-free number. So see if your country A has an MCI operator in it. And number two, if your country allows toll-free calling to the United States. So if you have those two factors, you can call us toll-free. Now, if you don't have that, what you do is you email me and say, I want to make a call, David. What is your actual phone number? And I will give you the actual country code. Actually, I don't know the country code for the United States, but I will give you the area code. And
it's, I think, 011. David.
Well, that's what I dial to call out, but is that also our country code?
That might, you know, once again, don't quote me, but I mean, I've used it. That's, I think, the U.S. country code of 011.
Okay, so I when I call out to another country, I have to dial 011 and then their country code and area code and number. So, but anyway, that's, and I'll give you the number that you can call. Now, if you're using Skype and you want to call us, like Kim does from Mexico, so Kim calls the toll-free number from her Skype line in Mexico, and I would say 75% to 80% of the time her Skype call is okay quality for calling the show. Not all of them work, but most of the time they work. So that's another option if you're outside the country. You can dial the toll-free number if you have a decent Skype connection. So Bob has, we have a couple more minutes, and we would actually love to hear from you. And if you want to get in on any of these discussions we've had, come on, jump in on the fray here and let us hear from you.
No, the regulars have been calling, that's for sure.
Marshall is on and off depending on where he is on the farm. So
right,
he's but John Hunt hasn't called. He usually calls. In fact, I'm surprised SLS John has not called to take issue with your SLS
and
Orion.
Well, the last time John and I talked on your show, John was very was shifting his position. He was he said it. He was very impressed with his
with Falcon Heavy. Yes,
he first stage. And he was beginning to rethink his love of SLS.
No, but he still thinks it is a placeholder for the aerospace industry for better days and better times.
Oh, well, okay. Then where are you, John? You got to defend yourself because I'm ripping the SLS.
And I forget,
and I won't stop.
I forget who the guest was, and I've asked you about this before.
What?
And I think it was one of the space attorneys. It may have been Laura Montgomery. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But her comment about SLS being a government project, expensive, this, that, and the other, and all this BS. She said she doesn't look at it. And again, it may not be Laura, so listeners don't think it's
right.
Laura unless I can prove it, and I'm unable to.
But whoever said this, what did they?
So whoever said this, and I believe it was a woman, said that you have to look at SLS the same way you look at the government for helping to provide space infrastructure for cislunar space, because SLS is part of enabling the space industry to do bigger and greater things and is an infrastructure item, not specifically a launch vehicle. So if you look at it as part of needed space infrastructure with a giant kick-ass fairing and stuff like that, that will open up opportunities for different kinds of missions and bigger missions and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, then you get a different perspective on SLS, much the way you would get using government-supplied or partially financed infrastructure to develop cislunar space.
That is the exact argument that was used for the space shuttle, and what that did was destroy the launch industry in the United States. It's taken almost 4 decades to recover the industry.
Times may
money.
Be different now because there are other launch industry companies that are not going away.
Right, but you see, SLS cannot provide that. SLS cannot provide that infrastructure because it's too expensive. No one's going to buy it.
But government
and what it launches are then it builds the platform around the moon that then private launch companies can aim for and tourism can aim for. And that might be an argument. But what I said in my op-eds about the Outer Space Treaty is that what built the United States was our federal government and the local governments as well recognized that the government's infrastructure that it must establish has nothing to do with railroads or roads or anything like that. The infrastructure the government must provide is a legal framework to allow the citizens and the companies and the people who are going to do it a legal foundation to a trustworthy, reliable legal foundation to make what they do succeed. And so in the United States, what the federal government focused on is establishing federal law and local law and state territories that would eventually evolve into state governments that are equal standards with the older states, so that the citizens in those territories, those initially settled territories, knew they had a framework, a reliable, trustworthy framework that they could build on, build their companies and their dreams upon. And what space needs, the government, federal government should be doing is focusing on that. Building a space station is not really achieving what the government really needs to do. Granted, like ISS provides it creates a need. The government needs launch services, so therefore they buy it from the private sector. And yes, that's in a sense providing an infrastructure for space. But the truth of the matter is, it's too much of a government boondoggle, and it's really not what we need. The government is in the way. I mean, the recent hearings that took place that Ted Cruz ran in the Senate, in which at one point he had Bigelow on to talk about space station work, and he wasn't the only one. There were other ones who talked about this too. The way the space station is structured, it interferes with private space stations and private enterprise in space because you got to work through NASA. And what they want to do is be able to start launching their own space stations to do their own research and profit making in manufacturing in space, and they don't have the legal framework for them to do this safely, and it's hurting them. That's what the government infrastructure should be. And talking about, you know, this was the argument they made with the space shuttle. We will have a low-cost launch system which will allow private enterprise to go, so nothing else can launch on the United States. No United States satellite can launch except on the space shuttle. Our launch industry got destroyed, and the space shuttle did not provide us 50 launches a year at low cost. It was a giant, expensive, heavy thing that did not achieve what it was supposed to achieve.
Well,
it was a government operation. And that's what SLS will be. But this time there are private companies that can compete with it and will make it pointless to build it. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, Dave.
Well, skip to it. Stick to it, but I totally disagree with you.
Oh, good.
And I have no more ability to prove my opinion than you have to prove yours. But we wait and see. I would actually like to see the development of space infrastructure, including upgraded ground resources, which are needed to be public-private partnerships, not just government expenditures. So everyone comes in and says, but the government did the interstate highways, they did the airmail, they did this, they did that. All of that was true, but we didn't have a robust private sector and a robust economy back then, and we still do, despite, you know, the fact that our economy has a lot of problems and has a lot of things.
The roads were built by the private sector. The government determined where the roads would be.
A government project, but everything's built. The space shuttle was built by the private sector, too.
The key distinction is ownership. The roads are owned by the government.
And so was the shuttle. And
but
so
Falcon
is the
Heavy is not owned, and Falcon 9 is not, and Dragon is not owned.
So I'm just saying I would like whatever space infrastructure gets built for cislunar space, including ground infrastructure, which is needed, to be more of a public-private orientation than just government only.
Okay. Well, that's moving in a direction I absolutely agree with.
And because if it is government only, then it will be owned by government only, and they will control the shots. And the government is not always benevolent in how they own and manage things.
In recent decades, they've been.
And we pay huge taxes with gasoline and stuff to maintain the highway, and the bastards siphon the money off and use it for other things. So,
speaking like a true Californian.
This happens on the federal level, not just the state level here. And so a lot of the deferred maintenance raises the cost of public structures.
This is where they get into issues of ownership. For example, if NASA needed a deep space network to communicate with its planetary probes, and rather than building its own, it put out the request for bid every few years, you would get competitive, much more efficiently designed, innovative designed infrastructure, and cheaper, and it would be more capable. We already are beginning to see that satellite companies are beginning to create their own, it's not a deep space network, but their own communications networks for themselves, for their own satellites, using very simple antennas on top of rooftops, and they just simply have to put them up there. It doesn't cost them a lot of money, and it's very simple. It doesn't take a lot of labor, and they're developing that technology so that they can communicate with their satellite constellations from the ground without great cost. And though deep space communications with a planet probe in Saturn is much more complicated, it's not something that can't be done less difficult. You know, it can be done more effectively than NASA's doing it today. There's no doubt about that in my mind. And so I agree with you. Put it more in the hands of the private sector. Let them own it and let them make money from it and make it a profit issue and take the power out of NASA's hand. In Capitalism Space, my paper, you can download it free from Behind the Black. It's a PDF. The link's right at the top in the menu. You should read it because it will give you an idea of what the history has been like the last 2 decades and how commercial space has beaten big government in every step of the way. But in that, I talk about how ownership is the key question. SLS is owned by NASA, even though private companies are building different components of it. It's a Frankenstein monster in how it's designed. So really the only owner is NASA, and NASA's only interest there is a big space project. It has no marketable practicality.
Well, and I don't think NASA's going to rent it or lease it out or sell it to a government, to a private user.
No one will buy it. it's too expensive. It's not a practical item, and it wasn't built with practicality in mind or cost effectiveness. SpaceX owns Falcon 9. They provide services to NASA to get Dragon capsule, which they also own, up to ISS, but they think in terms of cost effectiveness and efficiency, so they make it very practical and very efficient because it belongs to them, and they have the opportunity to make money from these things in other from other outlets, from other customers. And so they're very focused on profit and efficiency. And so ownership is the key here. In SLS, once again, there's many different contractors building different components of it.
But it's government owned,
the
yeah.
whole thing. NASA owns it, and therefore government doesn't care about efficiency or cost or time frame.
Well, and they, so far, NASA has said they are not going to make it available to the private sector.
Well, NASA can say that. But if NASA was saying, we're going to make it available, here it is, no one's going to buy it.
Nobody would buy it.
Yeah, it's not cost effective. It's you're talking about anywhere, depending on how you want to amortize the cost per launch could be anywhere from $3 to $14 billion based upon how you want to amortize it. So even at best, Frank, even at the best, let's say I'll even cut it in half, $1 billion a launch, which is about comparable to the Saturn V, and I think that's the minimum number anyone has said, is still 10 times more than SpaceX is going to charge for a Falcon Heavy.
But all I can say is this is why Kickstarter was invented.
That's a good point. It's free market, freedom, go to the best product and pay money for that, Think of from NASA's point of view, and think of the Deep Space Gateway. You want a Heavy Lift launch, you can get at a minimum 10 Falcon Heavy launches, and you'll be able to get them by 2020, almost certainly, for the cost, the minimum cost that of the most optimistic budget person for an SLS launch. SLS costs really a lot more than $1 billion per launch. I mean, when you think it's going to cost $43 billion to get to that first manned launch, two launches, say three if you want to count the test launch that wasn't done on an SLS, that's more than $10 billion a launch if you amortize it out intelligently. And there's no comparison. So no one's going to buy the product, and that's why NASA's never is going to say, we're not going to let it to the private sector, we're too good for that, because they'd be embarrassed if they did.
We're coming up on 2 hours, so what have we omitted that we should have talked about?
Well, I mean, I went to see the eclipse.
Oh, I didn't I've been asking everybody else about the eclipse. Where did you go see it at?
Well, this is almost 2 years ago, I'm doing an article for Sky and Tell, and I'm talking to an amateur astronomer, and he tells me about the eclipse, and he sends me all the information. So more than 2 years before it happened, I knew about it. And then Diane and I, my wife, were talking about going up the glacier. And I said, okay, I'm going to pin the trip to Glacier to going to the eclipse. So we drove up on our way to Glacier to Idaho Falls. The first day La Quinta opened up reservations for that date, which was 1 year before the date, I was on the phone with them to make a reservation. And by the way, I wasn't the first on the phone. I was like, they were half filled already. This is a year before the eclipse. So I made a reservation for La Quinta hotel room. They charged a lot of money. It was much more than the normal going
rate. Oh, yeah, they saw everybody coming, right?
Oh, well, it's a good business. I don't resent that. That's good business. There was a demand.
Small set does. That's what happens with the hotels in Logan, Utah. For a small set, the price goes up.
Right.
It's a great business opportunity.
Yeah, and I had no resentment of that at all. That's the way business works. It's not gouging. That's the way business works. And it was okay. I could have done other things that wouldn't cost as much, but we wouldn't have been as comfortable. I wanted to be comfortable. So we went. They made T-shirts for everybody who was there. Everyone in that hotel was there for the eclipse, which was kind of cool. And they handed out eclipse glasses, though I had bought some for myself. If you go to my website and click and do a search for eclipse, you can also go to the column on the right, the last 5 essays and commentaries, and you can see it's still there, the eclipse. You can click on that, and you'll see some pictures that I took and my wife took at the event. It was a really amazing thing. Psychologically, I think in our brains, we kind of think the sun kind of roars up in the sky. But when you hit totality and it becomes dark and you can take the glasses off and you can look at this glowing ring of the corona, it suddenly seems very quiet. And everyone does get very quiet. And it's dark like at night, but not really like night. And it was really an awe-inspiring experience. I can see why people become addicted to going to eclipses. We had about 2 minutes of totality. It was really cool. The hotel did a nice job of, they provide, I forgot to bring my camp chairs, and so they had extra chairs for people, which was very
well,
nice.
Well, I watched it on the internet. We were fogged in where I lived in, the Bay Area.
Yeah, I decided, you know, when I was like 8 years old, there was an annular eclipse that crossed New York City. So as a little kid, there was, you know, it didn't quite cover the sun. There was a ring. You could never look at it. You had to look at it through a pinhole.
Right.
And but you could see the darkness come on, and it was definitely a change. And for my whole life, I said, I want to see an eclipse. But just, you know, it's a lot of travel, and there hadn't been really any across the United States. When I heard this, I said, you know, the worst two words in the English language is if only. I don't want to ever say that. I like to say next time, I'm going to make it happen. So I took the bull by the horns and made it happen. And it was really pretty cool to have seen it. And it's one thing off my bucket list. I wouldn't mind seeing another one, but, you know, this was worth it.
Well, there's another one in a couple of years that goes through Houston.
Yeah, it's going to be across north to south,
north
2024.
To uh-huh.
And that's also not that far away for me in distance, but I got it done. One of the other things that really struck me during the eclipse, once again, this is something I knew already, but it really pounds home when you're sitting there and watching it, is the miraculous coincidence that our moon should be just the perfect distance away to produce these very short eclipses periodically in such a perfect manner. And eclipses are a significant event in the history of the human race learning something about the universe. In science, they were significant events in trying to figure out what the universe was like, and they couldn't happen unless you had this really miraculous coincidence of distance and size, and really specific coincidence. And there's all, you know, I'm not a religious man, and I absolutely do not believe in any religions as they're present, because the rituals don't mean anything to me. But I also do believe that there is a greater power in the universe, and this sure is this sure indicates something there. That's for sure.
I don't know. I take my eclipse training from Merlin, so.
Who gave Merlin his abilities?
It comes from the crazy hat that he wears. I mean, that's where all his power is. And it was their version of a pyramid hat, and that's where all the power.
But where does the power come to?
That's the universe. That's how the universe works.
Well, they always come back to, why are we here? And that's a philosophical question of great.
I have no idea why I even do the show sometimes.
to ask me why I am here is
bigger than I can handle.
Most of what we talk about is the fundamental question of how. How does the universe function? How are we going to get into space? How are we going to colonize the planets? But the why is a philosophical question of great depth. Religion's human race has filled endless libraries and books trying to come up with answers from that, including in almost as many religions as there are people on the earth. And that's not to denigrate any religion, but it's to say that there's a question here that has not been answered. But the nature of the eclipse surely suggests an intelligent design behind the universe. It surely does.
We're not going there, Bob.
You're not supposed to. It's politically incorrect. I'm a secular humanist, but I'm not allowed to say that. I know that.
Well, you just said it.
That's right. Because I have never been stopped from saying, when someone tells me I'm not allowed to say something, David, you know what that's going to result in.
No,
I say my mind. I always will, and that's never going to change.
No, you can say you're a libertarian or secular. I just don't want to do the partisan stuff. Because
this brings us back to space. You are describing a government operation versus the private sector. Bring this issue up because it does illustrate my point about capitalism in space, how the private sector and private enterprise and competition has opened up the United States to dominating the launch industry in the coming years and dominating the exploration of the solar system in the coming years, because we have competition and freedom.
Appears a competition in launch industry for sure is going to continue.
And, yeah.
I think that's
right
really
now,
solid.
Yes, this was what is it now, 7 years ago, David, when Obama canceled Constellation, and I was on the show with you, I said, my first words out of my mouth were, this is a mess. It's going to screw things up. Congress is going to micromanage things. It's going to be a mess, which is what SLS is, by the way. And it's going to be a mess. And the only hope we've got is this emerging private sector competition coming from SpaceX and Orbital Sciences at the time, and now Orbital ATK. And if they can succeed, they will give us an option that will get us out of under the thumb of government.
But by the way, we didn't talk about the ATK Orbital Northrop merger.
No, we didn't.
Anything you want to say real quick about it?
Well, it's an interesting situation. The way my first reaction was, you know, Northrop Grumman has pretty much been out of the space industry now for several decades, and this is maybe their attempt as a company to get in that market. They have their corporate people see this is a fast way that corporation can re-enter what they see as a growing, an emergent industry, and they have some of the expertise and some parts of their company fit well with this, the launch and space industry. So they need a way to get into space, and Orbital ATK gives them that.
Absolutely.
And so that's the thinking, the corporate thinking, I think, behind it. Will it be a good thing? That's a different story because, you know, Northrop Grumman is this giant company that is very big space corporation, just like Boeing and Lockheed Martin. And Orbital ATK has managed to do as well as it has because it's a small, somewhat innovative, flexible company. It tries things. It takes risks. I mean, the whole Cygnus and Antares setup was a gigantic risk for them, and they took it. And they succeeded with it, and it's gotten them big contracts for it, but it was a risk. And whether Northrop Grumman will allow that or not, the corporate culture, once again, could change the company, and that's where we're
Bob, I forgot to thank our sponsors for the second period
because we didn't take a
break. Let me thank you and listeners. We do appreciate Bob being with us, and I wonder why you all didn't call a pox on all your houses for that. But Bob will be back on in a couple of months.
They're free to comment on Behind the Black if they want.
Or on the Space Show blog.
That's right.
And Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace, and it'll be interesting to see, and I hope that they do continue to be a sponsor for 2017. The merger is supposed to go through in the early part of 2018, but they are known as the partner you can count on in advanced reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then AIAA is a sponsor, and again, that's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, with more than 30,000 individual members, 88 countries represented, 95 corporate members, and they shape the future of aerospace every day. Check them out for all of their many events, AIAA.org. And then, of course, Celestis is a sponsor, and they are the only really truly iconic player and proven provider for Memorial Spaceflight Services around the world. And they offer flights from Cape Canaveral at Kennedy Space Center and also New Mexico. They have a Celestis Earth Orbit launch scheduled for earlier next year. And they're going to go on a Surrey Satellite Technology satellite. Now that's a foreign satellite launch on a Falcon Heavy. And that's going to launch from the pad at Kennedy Space Center 39A that the Apollo astronauts used to go to the moon. Family and friends will gather in Cocoa Beach, and that they're going to have a three-day experience where they get a tour of Kennedy Space Center, dinner with astronauts, a memorial service, and all sorts of really great things. And you'll get to see the Falcon Heavy rocket. And I will say again that I'm a customer of Celestis, and they're a wonderful and very sensitive organization to be involved with, one of the best businesses I've ever worked with. So if you do have someone you want to remember this way, or you want your DNA to go to space, this is a great way to do it. So check them out, Celestis.com. And Bob, if you don't have any other last-minute contributions, I will say goodnight to you.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure. Until next time.
I think that is in late November.
The date is November 21st.
Yeah, late November. So, listeners, that's it. So, Hotel Mars is an unknown for tomorrow, so check the website for that. And Friday, we're back, and then Sunday, we're back. So everybody have a great week. Gil Levin, by the way, of Mars Viking is on Friday. And then Michael Listener, our space attorney friend, is with us on Sunday. Good night from Bob Zimmerman, all of you who emailed us. And thank you all. Have a great week. Keep looking up and keep it safe. Good night from Bob. Good night from David and the Space Show.